Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now, this week, ahead of Ridley Scott's Napoleon, which is released later this month, we are heading back to the very start of his directorial debut with 1977's The Duelists.
Yes, with Napoleon coming up soon, we thought, what else can we do out of all of the Napoleonic War films that are out there? And then it occurred to us, of course, Ridley Scott's debut. It's Napoleonic epic of vignettes, and it's the perfect way to prime ourselves ready for Napoleon at the end of the month. I always really enjoyed the film, so I'm looking. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about it, because it's an interesting way of making a film about this period, because it shows very little of the period. But it really nails the mise-en-scène of all the little vignettes it actually creates.
Yeah, it feels quite real, doesn't it? It feels quite true in its own interesting way. Maybe you should do cast this week, and then I'll do some production.
So the film is led by the eponymous duelists. Keith Carradine plays Armand Dubert, who is a hussar lieutenant. He's one of the Carradine family. Known for Emperor of the North, Nashville in 1975, Welcome to LA in 76. He was Wild Bill Hickok in a 1995 Western biopic. He was also in lots of TV, including Deadwood and Dexter. And then our other lead is Harvey Keitel, who plays Gabriel Ferreau. And he's had an incredible career, including Taxi Driver, Welcome to LA as well. Wise Guys, Dear Gorbachev, Thelma and Louise, Bad Lieutenant, Reservoir Dogs, From Dusk Till Dawn, Pulp Fiction, U-571, which we've covered on the show, The Grey Zone, the National Treasure movies, Inglourious Basterds, Moonrise Kingdom. He's even done a few Wes Anderson movies, Grand Budapest and Isle of Dogs. Recently, he was also in The Irishman. So he's had an incredibly varied career. He was in the diary as Winston, as his character from Pulp Fiction, wasn't
he?
And then another notable name that is only in it for one scene is Albert Finney, who plays Joseph Foch, who is the Minister of Police for the restored monarchy. And he has a single scene, and he was apparently paid with a case of champagne for that one scene. Radagrad, four-time Oscar nom. Played Churchill in The Gathering Storm in 2002. That
less said about that, the better.
That well, HBO that series. That was a good one, I think.
That was a good one. Yeah,
it was the Brian Cox one that wasn't very good.
Yes, I get confused sometimes. Yeah.
It was that glut of early 2000s,
Churchill things.
Like biopics. Then we've got Edward Fox, who plays a Bonapartist colonel who kind of tries to recruit Dubert when Napoleon returns from exile during the Hundred Days campaign. And he was in Oh, What a Lovely War, Battle of Britain, Day of the Jackal, A Bridge Too Far, of course, Soldier
Keep
of Orange.
Keep your tanks on the move.
Force 10 from Navarone in 1978, The Bounty, Wild Geese 2, Return from the River Kwai, River Kwai Harder.
That's not what it's called, surely.
And then we have Tom Conti as an army surgeon who's at the beginning of the film, who plays De Bear's friend. He was in The Fall of Eagles in 1974, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence in 83, and he most recently played Albert Einstein in Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. And one thing I really like about his character is he plays the flute and it becomes like a diegetic soundtrack, and that motif gets repeated throughout the film. Yeah, it's a really beautiful little piece as well. Then we've got Christina Rains as Adele, who's later Dubert's wife. She was also in Nashville with Carradine and in tons of film and TV.
They were going out at the time, weren't they? That's why she's in it.
Is that right? I didn't read that.
They were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time. So apparently that's why she's in the film.
Casting is so much easier when you're going out with someone. Right. Then we've got Alan Armstrong, who plays Dubert's second for the first duel, his friend. He was in Get Carter in 71, A Bridge Too Far, of course.
Within a bloody ammo dump. That's two Bridge Too Far quotes this week.
Then we've got Patriot Games, 1992, Braveheart, 1995. And of course, he was in lots of TV.
New Tricks.
Including New Tricks.
Used to love it.
Meg Wynne Owen is Leonie, who's Dubert's sister. Again, lots of TV and film. Alan Webb as Adele, Dubert's uncle, wife's uncle. He was in The Cruel Sea as Admiral Maury Forbes.
Wow.
As an uncredited role. He was also in The Silent Enemy in 1958, and he was in The Falstaff in 1965. We have a couple of other early career actors that went on to be quite recognizable UK character actors, including people like Hugh Fraser, who plays one of the officers in the background. He was in Firefox in 1982. He was Wellington in Sharp throughout most of the 90s. He was also in the Lost Battalion as a French general. And he was also Captain Hastings in all the ITV Poirot adaptations as well.
Wow.
Pete Postlethwaite as an orderly for, I think, Telleran.
No, wait, when was he? I didn't even notice that.
Yeah,
when
he's literally in the background, stood behind Telleran, and I think he says one line in the whole thing.
Wow.
But, you know, he was in Tumbledown, he was in Sharp as well, he was in Alien 3, Last of the Mohicans. And obviously, they're just things that are loosely associated with the genre we cover.
Not to mention, all of these people have done things like that, you know.
Exactly. All these people have done so much more. Liz Smith, perhaps best known for being Nana in the Royal Family.
Nana.
She was also in Vicar of Dibley. But again, she's one of those actors that has had a massive TV and film career. She was a Wren during World War II, and she plays a tarot card reader in the film, and she kind of warns off Dubert's mistress. And in a nice little scene where she lays down like the upturned swords, and she says, beware of the, you know, essentially duelists.
The duelists.
Then we have Stacey Keach as the narrator. And finally, William Morgan or W. Morgan Shepherd appears as the offensive master, who has one line where he's training Carradine's character, just tweaking his skills. And probably our generation know him best as the narrator of the Medal of Honor games.
Yes. How cool is that?
Colonel Hargrove, I think the character's name is in the games. But he was also in Gettysburg and Gods and Generals. He was in The Dirty Dozen, The Next Mission, of course, and you know, a range of other things. And that kind of rounds out this week's cast. Lots of people that were, you know, became recognizable.
Mm.
Two great leads. Solid cast, I think.
No, it really is. It's one of the things the movie's got going for it. And I think the casting choices might become apparent when we do production, but, you know, they only get Keitel because he's been released from Apocalypse Now. He was replaced by Sheen. So, you know, he's knocking about and is available. So it's like a sort of everything falls into place for this one. You know, I always wonder what an Apocalypse Now with Keitel would have been like. Just out of interest. I know there's those rushes they did, and I think there's a few screen.
Sheen's great.
Oh, Sheen's brilliant.
That would
have
been really interesting.
Keitel's got this toughness to him that I wonder what would have bought that role. But Sheen didn't quite have that toughness.
No.
He had it in a different way. Yeah.
A lot to talk about when we finally get round to Apocalypse Now, that's for sure.
Crikey, when hell are we going to do that? quick, Matt, we'll talk about popular movies. Quick, segue into production.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Directed by the aforementioned Ridley Scott, who cut his teeth in TV advertising in the UK, probably most notable for his 1973 Hovis advert Bike Round, which is the one where the lad's pushing a bike up a famous street. Yeah. And it was voted the UK's most popular advert in 2006.
God, on one of those awful 2000s.
Channel 4,
like,
top 100.
Where they put it on for like 6 hours and you'd be sat there watching it and being like, why am I watching this?
And it'd just be like, you know, professional rememberers going like, oh, I remember this. It was right. God,
oh,
like,
yes, the talking heads.
Yeah, talking heads.
I just bought a Ford Allegra at the time. that's not even the right name of the car.
I'll have some bread. No, Riley. Who's Riley? Sorry. Scott's credits, of course, include Alien, Blade Runner, Thelma and Louise, G.I. Jane, Gladiator, Black Hawk Down, The Last Duel, and of course, the upcoming Napoleon biopic called Napoleon on Apple TV. You know, the guy is probably one of the greatest British directors of his generation. You know, he's done so many huge movies. Love him or hate him. The film was produced by Dave Putnam, who listeners might remember, he produced Memphis Belle. He also produced Chariots of Fire and The Killing Fields, among others. And the movie itself is based on a 1908 short story by Joseph Conrad, another Apocalypse Now reference here, who wrote Hearts of Darkness, of course, the book that is Apocalypse Now is based off of.
Keitel was like, if I'm not going to do one, I'm going to do the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, must have been weird going from being in one Conrad adaptation to go to being in a more straight Conrad adaptation. That must have been quite. Maybe that's why he took it. I couldn't find anything solid on that.
No.
But the story itself first appeared in the Pall Mall magazine, and it was chosen by Scott as it was a public domain piece because at the time, Scott's a relatively unknown director in terms of features, at least. And it had a screenplay that had already been written by Gerald Vaughan Hughes, which is his biggest writing credit. He worked on TV dramas in the 70s, like Play for Today, ITV Playhouse, things like that. Consummate drama writer. And Scott purchased the scripts and approached Paramount Pictures to make the movie. And eventually he got them to agree to, now I can't find an actual figure. Some places say this one, some places say that one. So it's from $900,000 to $1.5 million, but it's still an absolute micro budget in terms of
even
a feature.
Even for the late 70s, that's minuscule.
Yeah. So Ridley was given quite free rein, apparently, in terms of, you know, set design, things like that, cinematographer, his staff. Yeah, he was given quite a lot of free rein, but he was given a list of actors that he could choose from. So getting Keitel and Carradine wasn't necessarily his choices, but, you know, they were from a list. And there's no box office take, but we can assume this one's gone on to be successful because of the career Scott's had and the fact that it won awards. So it was the winner of two 1977 Cannes Film Award awards, one for Best Director, Best Debut Feature for Scott. And it almost won the Palme d'Or, the best film at the Cannes, but it was only nominated. won a David D. Donatello Award for Best Foreign Director, and it was nominated for two 1979 BAFTAs, including Best Cinematography and Best Costume Design.
I can definitely get behind those, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently, Scott even had to, harkening back to the budget issues, Scott had to pay for some of the pre-production expenses from his own pocket and later being reimbursed when the film was made. So it's a real, you know, real sort of.
I wonder if the 900,000 figure was actual filming budget, and then the rest on top, the extra 600,000 was kind of like post-production and advertising and stuff like that. Yeah.
It could have been. I think the AFI film catalog said 1.5 million and Wikipedia said 900,000. And I tend to believe AFI catalog, if I'm honest, because it cites its sources. cinematography for this one was by Frank Tidy. He worked on April Morning as a director of photography. No, Matt likes that one. The Package with Gene Hackman, which sounds incredible. Gene Hackman having to go and nab Tommy Lee Jones in Cold War Berlin.
Ooh.
Sounds good, doesn't it? Hackman's ex-CIA, and he gets brought in to capture Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones, that sounds amazing.
Sounds great. Tidy also worked on Hitler's Daughter, Stop or My Mum Will Shoot, and Under Siege. So what a great little credit list there. Mm. So the film's look was heavily inspired by Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, and invokes the paintings of the time. You get these lovely little static shots that will zoom back out, and it could feel like it's a contemporary painting. It's beautifully shot.
Yeah, of course, because a lot of the cinematography and set design for Kubrick's movie was influenced by contemporary paintings of the 18th century. So I can definitely see where Scott's gone for that exact same element with the 19th century, because right at the very end of the film, we've got to mention it now because we're talking about it, but right at the end of the film, there's a shot of Keitel over the shoulder where he's looking out over a valley, which is a beautiful landscape shot. And that is so heavily influenced by all those paintings of mid-19th century paintings of Napoleon wistfully on the Isle of Elba.
That's great.
It's just
like, it evokes so much. Like, I'm sure we'll talk about the ending again, but like, you just, spoiler alert, Keitel is just dejected. Like,
yeah,
living for him is worse than death. And Carradine knows it. And I love that's his punishment. I love that. Yeah, you've got to live in a world you hate.
You know, absolutely. A country,
you know, it's just perfect.
Looking over that river as the sun breaks through the clouds. It's just a beautiful shot.
Yeah. Reminds me of that shot in The Gathering Storm, actually, where Finney's looking out over England. A little bit like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just evokes it a little bit there. And the music for The Duelist was composed by English composer Howard Blake, who also worked on the soundtracks of The Snowman and Flash Gordon. So some great talent. And the music's interesting. It does a lot of mood setting. There's not a lot of music, but when it's there, it's very much the scene needs it. So if it's a happy thing, it's a happy. If it's sad, it's sad. You know, it's a real... a real mood evoker, I think, the soundtrack, to want a better phrase. This is a great fact, Matt, and I didn't know this until Matt told me, because he knew I was on production this week, and I was jumping. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So the film's historical advisor was the late, great Richard Holmes, most loved here at FOF HQ for his groundbreaking series, War Walks, from the mid-90s. I'm sure all the fans of the show absolutely love Richard Holmes' work, and to know that he was involved in this was just amazing. I could just...
And it seems to have been his only motion picture advisory role.
Yeah, what a... Advisory role. He does one and knocks it out of the park, you know. I expect nothing less from Holmes.
Yeah. No, it's... Yeah. I have no idea what kind of involvement he had, but he is listed on there, and got to be said that the film doesn't get too much wrong, really, in terms of
well, that's Holmes for you, you know,
vibe and mise-en-scène and stuff, but really interesting.
That's great. I said to Matt, I like to think he's on set somewhere talking to someone who like worked in TV or film, going, well, I've got this idea for a series, like I want to walk around and I want to talk about wars. I just can't think of a name. It's like to think that happened. And the fight choreography was done by Master Swordsman William Hobbs, who worked on HMS Defiant, Three Musketeers, Flash Gordon, King Lear, Rob Roy, Game of Thrones. And he also features in the movie as a swordsman. And the sword scenes themselves, one of the dueling scenes, which is later on I'll talk about, it's my favourite scene, but in the third duel in the sunken basement, there is a chicken wire on the wall that's electrified to give sparks. And apparently yeah. Keitel reported being shocked on set when it went off. It's lovely and safe.
That just nods to that ad hoc, you know, small budget production.
Yeah, it really, really, really does.
Improvising
it?
That kind of effect just to create. Because that seems really... really claustrophobic and really brutal, and we'll not talk any more about it because it's your favorite scene.
No, it's fine, but it's just, you know, fantastic.
It is really a good one.
Filmed on location in the Dordogne region of France, with the Cairngorms of Scotland filling in for the Russian front, and the final duel was filmed at the Chateau de Comarque in the Dordogne.
I read that none of it was shot in studio and it was all shot on location.
Don't think it was.
Nothing was built for it.
No, I think it was. I think that's maybe another budgetary restraint. You don't have the funds available to shoot on a soundstage.
Doesn't that make it better for it?
Like, it really does. Yeah.
There's a number of scenes, like when they're in the cafe and there's people outside milling around, and one of Faroe's seconds sort of walks down the street, and the table's littered with whatever lunch they've just eaten. They're chatting away.
It's got a dinge to it.
And it's, yes, it does. And it's
really
nicely lit. Really beautifully framed. There's a load of shots in all of the vignettes that are just like that. Really nicely framed, great depth of field.
Oh, it's beautiful. Like, it's, I think it's one of Scott's most beautifully shot films. I really do think it's possibly one of his best, possibly is his best for me, having watched it, in terms of everything
the thought
coming together.
To me too. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about more at the end.
It does come together really well.
It really does. And so we have a retro review for you this week from David Hughes of Empire Magazine from January 2000, ahead of the DVD release. Remember those? They were good, weren't they? and he says, heavily influenced by Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, the film is loosely inspired by Joseph Conrad's short story, The Duel. Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel are officers in Napoleon's army who confront each other in a series of increasingly violent duels, which begin with a minor incident but escalate over the course of 30 years into an all-consuming passion that rules and ultimately ruins the lives of both men. I think it was 15 years, Mr.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite 30. I think perhaps he was getting confused with the actual two gentlemen that it was... you know, based on, and their 30 duels. Perhaps he'd done his research, but
maybe. In an all-consuming passion that rules and ultimately ruins the lives of both men. The story sounds flimsy, but the richness of Scott's visuals and the excellent performances of Finney, Edward Fox, Tom Conti, and Robert Stevens are among the supporting cast, and depth of the themes, masculine pride, and obsession masquerading as honour combine to make the movie a masterpiece.
Pretty good, yeah.
Snappy, it's good. That's what I like. Empire Magazine.
That's on the money.
They wrote them in podcast format. They just didn't know. That's why I like
They wrote them for you to read.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So we have the one-word review again, and we had 97 responses, a bunch of retweets, nearly 250 likes. Thanks, guys. We absolutely love the engagement. We love hearing what you think about the movies way before me and Matt sit down to record. It's always lovely to see. So in no particular order, Ryan Williams goes with Hussars. Adam Christian says apology. AD Bond says sharp. Alex Patterson goes with, and it's long, but I like it, the scene where you see a girl herding geese down the road through the window. I fully believe I'm looking at a real moment. Kenton White goes with the best film ever made. I've been writing about the French officer one of the characters was based on. We'd love to know more, Kenton. Aaron Matter goes with outstanding. Marcus Cribb goes with swashbuckling. Ian McKellen, sabres. Alan Taylor, awesome. Tom Fox goes pistols. We have Martin Collins, tight pants. And we'll end with Tony Wilshire, who goes with sublime.
I did see a couple of people that mentioned Overblown as well, and I think we might talk about that later on.
What's that? Let me quickly scroll through. Let me find the naysayers. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, but I think generally speaking, it's well regarded and people enjoy the film. But I can also see where you might criticize it for being a little bit overblown. If you aren't someone that can sit through
Keith Carradine getting bullied for an hour and 40.
Yeah. If you aren't really interested in the concept of honor and the weird masculine attachments that comes with, then would not be the film for you.
If the pomp and circumstance is too much for you, I can definitely see why you wouldn't enjoy it. But that's why I like it, because I just think it's mad that these guys, Carradine's essentially like, come with me, and Keitel's like, no, I want to fight you. It's like, that's the whole movie. Like, I do sometimes love a plot that basic.
Oh, no, totally. The moral of the story is A, don't shoot the messenger, and B, never volunteer for anything.
True.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, don't volunteer, don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah. And both men are guilty of either one. It's great. Yeah. I love that. So maybe moving on to the Ally Tally this week.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
It's time for Ally Tally on Fighting on Film.
It's a film that's premised around single combat and honor. So arguably, we haven't actually covered a film that is so chivalry and swords.
You maybe see scenes with firearms in it twice, I think. Like the Russian sequences.
The Russian sequence and then the duel at the end, I think, are the only two. But it's great. So the film starts off with a short sword duel where the mayor of Strasbourg's nephew or son gets run through by Keitel.
It's brutal. Like, I was like, Jesus, he kebabbed him. I was like, oh my God.
He really did. Yeah. That's a really interesting fight, and I'll probably talk about that in favorite scenes in a moment. But then the film transitions. So the first duel between Dubert and Ferreau is with sabers, and it's very ad hoc. It's in a yard. Then they have a rematch, which is, you know, short swords. And then there's a mounted duel. There's a duel in the barn.
They're about to joust with swords, don't they?
They do. And, you know, it's a tribute to the cavalry. And then there's that sequence where they're about to have a pistol duel on the steppes of Russia. But the Cossacks intervene, and that gets, you know, postponed for about 4 years, 5 years. Yeah. And then they have a really interesting, it's not the classic two chaps at 20 paces from each other firing pistols. It's in open country, and they kind of move around at an abandoned chateau.
It's like a Vietnam War style, like cat and mouse, don't they?
They do. There's a great little shot where Dubert walks in front of the camera in the foreground, and right in the background, like Keitel's character Ferreau kind of skips across
in that sequence I can just see like an AD or someone behind the shot going, now turn now.
And then Carradine like turns and looks like, oh, I've missed him. Oh no.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's great. I love that scene. That it's really tense, and it isn't it feels way longer than it is.
Yeah, that's that very true.
It's very tense.
The film does a really great job throughout of building that tension, I think, especially and during the mounted sequence.
Yeah, and you're still not sure who's going to win. Because it's not like, and like one thing I did enjoy about the movie, obviously I haven't read the original story, but I like how, as a viewer, Carradine kind of wins. Then Keitel kind of wins, but it's not winning. Yeah. It's just getting away with the duel. It's not winning. Mm. So you do build to quite a tension. You don't know. You know, obviously as a viewer, we know who we're meant to be rooting for. We're meant to be rooting for Carradine because he's got way more skin in the game as a character, but you don't necessarily think he will.
It undermines that trope of setting up a character with so much to lose, new wife, new family. You think, oh God, Hubert's going to get it. But it kind of switches back, and it's a really interesting ending, which we'll talk about in a moment. Yeah. But just to get back to the Ali Tally.
Of course.
Interestingly, all of the swords used in the film, the sabers, as I should say, are pattern 1796, like cavalry sabers, which is actually, that's a British pattern of like cavalry saber rather than French. So the French will be using, I think it's year 9, like cavalry sabers, which have got more of a, I think it's a 3-bar hilt that's bronze.
Mon Dieu.
Whereas the 1796 has a single steel bogard kind of. And it is literally the classic saber because it became very popular during the Napoleonic period. And I think a number of European countries adopted it during that same period because it's a really flexible light blade for what it is. It can also chop a little bit. It's a very good slasher. If you're very skilled, you can use the point, which is a definitely handy thing for using it as a cavalry weapon, but I suppose also
deafing people up, you wanted to
for
say.
Being a duelist is helpful. Yeah. There's some interesting stuff going on with some of the during the short sword sequence. Carradine has a weird black glove on. I don't know whether you noticed that.
I noticed Keitel pirate-esque bandana.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was cool.
With the Cadenet's braids and stuff.
Yeah, like, love it. I'm gonna talk about those braids in a minute, actually. That's my only pick.
Is it really? That's
weirdly.
Cool.
It'll make sense in a minute.
So as I was gonna say, there's that unusual like black glove in where Carradine's character kind of they offer up to each other and he has this glove on, but you don't really know why he's got that on because you never really see that in any other any of the manuscripts on fencing and that kind of thing. So that must have been just something that Hobbes decided to throw in as a
perhaps
to differentiate the two characters from each other.
Well, apparently there was a bit of ad-libbing during those sequences because apparently Keitel had Mrs. Mark and Scott accused him of over-milking things sometimes to get a reaction. So apparently some bits in those sequences aren't 100% choreographed.
So interesting. I mean, I always thought that during that short sword duel, Carradine's sneeze is really funny.
Yeah.
He like halts the duel before it even begins just to sneeze.
It characterizes him. I like it.
It does.
It's great.
It does.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be the foppish dandy, whereas Keitel's more of a, you know, a brute.
Like a rugged.
Rugged
career soldier, rugged guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much ascribed to the Republic and Bonapartism.
Without a doubt. Yeah. He's a Bonaparte enjoyer.
He is. Whereas I think Carradine's character is just more go with the flow because there's that great sequence later on where like at his wedding dinner and the uncle says, you're come now, you're a royalist now.
Yeah.
And he's reluctant to really go in on Bonaparte because he knows that these things can flip and change so quickly.
Yeah, he just wants to get on with his life.
Yeah. He does, yeah.
So that's, I think that actually, sorry, go on, if you got more.
Go on, carry on.
No, it's fine. So I actually think that really transitioned into my Ellie pick perfectly, talking about the characterization there. So as I said in the production, the costume design was awarded, nominated for a BAFTA. So it was by BAFTA-winning costume designer Tom Rand. And you know, his work on the costuming is top notch. You know, it's very of a period. I mean, I'm not an expert in Napoleonic clothing. You know, I don't have loads of books on them like I do the Vietnam War. I've got a lovely little quote here from Rand. He said, "We decided to choose the most contrasting colours of two different regiments. The first to illustrate the cool aristocratic character of one man, Armand, and the second to show the hot-blooded temperament of the other, Veraud."
Nice. So we went with the blue and red for the the 7th Hussars for Veraud, and then the grey cool colours. The 3rd Hussars. Yeah, that's really clever.
Because in the I'm going to stop talking about the third duel because I'll forget. I have nothing to say about my favourite scene. I'll come back to that. But there's another thing I really like. So I like how the hairstyles and costumes subtly change with the time. So later in the movie, it says, "And time moved on, and so did military fashions." Mm-hmm. And Veraud keeps his Napoleon-esque look. He's got those braids. He's got this little Napoleonic sort of tash going on. And Veraud lets his hair down, trims his tash down a little bit. And I saw it as Armand's a progressive who wants to move with the times, wants to have his life. He sees a future. But Veraud is this closed, wants Napoleon Empire forever and wants that to be his life. Like that's what he's putting his lot with that. And he doesn't change and he's unwilling to change. It's like he's everything that his adversary isn't and vice versa. I just like that real... And it's not subtle because it's so obvious on the screen, but I really, really like that. And I think it's one of the few instances where something like that actually does help the film. It really helps these characters because we don't see a lot of Keitel's personal life. We barely see anything of him at all, really, apart from when he's sort of fighting and you get a few scenes of him having a drink and when he has that argument with Armand about Napoleon having like enemies and things like that. Like that's all you get of him. I just really love that. Like it was.
Well, they're polar opposites, aren't they? And the only thing that really links them is
they're the original shared, odd couple.
Is a shared concept of honor and chivalry.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the only thing they've got going for them is that they both adhere to this system of dueling and feuding, and I just think it's so great.
It definitely makes for a fascinating dynamic. Before we get off the Alitalia, like the only other thing I've got for this week, because although it's set in the Napoleonic period, we don't see a great deal of the Napoleonic period. We've already talked about the uniforms being
the Russian front bit is the only bit that feels Napoleonic.
Indeed,
warring.
That's the only time you actually see them on campaign. And in that you get, you know, a few cannons are being kind of pushed along the road and everyone's frozen and covered in frost.
It's Brown Best muskets, I think they have.
I was about to mention those. So they should really be Charleville French muskets, but because it was filmed in England, they probably only, you know, had Brown Bests available.
Yeah. Probably from like a local museum or something that they've rented, and to be honest,
who knows, Baptiste or something like that. But you know, they're covered in frost anyway, so you can't.
It's fine. You know, it's, nothing about this movie is inherently wrong that I can see. You know,
no. Again, the mise en scène for the film is very, very much on point. It really is. That really? Russian sequence actually is one of my favorites. So maybe we should move on to favorite scenes and chat.
Yeah,
about
let's
that.
Hop into favorite scenes.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
So I'll go first, because Matt's been talking about the whole bloody pod. I've got a bit Michael Caine there. The whole bloody pod.
Now he's Australian. Okay.
And you're only meant to talk about the favourite scenes, Matthew, in the favourite scene section. That was shocking. Sorry, sir, Michael Caine.
That's quite possibly your worst Caine yet.
They get progressively worse. I love it. So my favourite scene is that third duel. So as we mentioned, Scott is shooting it on a handheld camera in this vaulted barn, this sunken barn basement, and they only have 45 minutes of light left on the shoot. And because of the money constraints and everything else going on, he has to get it. So they go for it. And essentially what you see is that handheld sequence.
He's like, hook up the batteries on the chicken wire. We need to shoot this.
Get that fucking chicken wire going. Chuck Harvey again. We need to get it done. And I love it because it's just so visceral. You feel every hit of those sabers, every thud, every punch, every like bit of, feel like you feel spittle coming out of their mouth, like when they're goading each other. It's so good.
The bit where he flays off a bit of Armand's back as well is really.
Yeah. The gore in this is just so well done. It's, you know, like in horror films where you see someone's head get blown up, someone get like stabbed, and it's really like over the top.
A bucket of like corn.
Exactly.
Syrup.
Like this, it's something feels painful to look at.
Yeah.
Like it's like when he gets chibbed in the horse bit.
Is that the technical term?
Chibbed, yeah.
Chibbed.
Sorry. When he gets sliced, what don't we say? Like, I've never stabbed someone. There you go, stab. When he gets stabbed in the head, Keitel, like that bleed.
Yeah.
Like it just looks so painful. There's something about it. I think that's another thing the movie does so, so well.
Well, all of the wounds, like throughout the film, you do feel them. That initial one where Keitel, his sword arm is cut by. Dubert's saber in that, again, that first duel between the two of them is shot over the shoulder.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott apparently took the camera himself because he was used to doing that on commercial work and was moving around and getting all these great shots. And it feels very claustrophobic, very dynamic, and it works so well. And it's exactly the same sort of thing in that.
And that's why I love it. It's so visceral. It's up close and personal. I've got it down here as it feels like half sword fight, half pub car park brawl. Like, it just goes into sort of.
Have you ever seen Rob Roy?
No, I haven't.
Liam Neeson.
No.
So, I mean, obviously, Hobbs did the choreography, the sword choreography for that as well. And there's a final duel in that. I won't give you any spoilers, Rob, because, you know, I think you'd actually quite like that film.
Probably would.
Where they're fighting, and it feels very similar in that it's very, very brutal. Also in a confined space of a hall rather than a barn, but it's very similarly shot.
I might have seen that duel. Or am I thinking of the duel in Die Another Day? It might be.
Maybe.
That.
was Liam Neeson in that scene?
No, he wasn't. No.
Yeah, probably Die Another Day.
No. It was Maggie Smith's daughter, the son. Wasn't he in that one? Maggie Smith's son?
Yes, he was. Film? Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Yes,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway, quite quick, claw the podcast back. But, you know, again, in that scene, the lighting, the setting, it's just beautiful. Like, you've got onlookers, which I really like. People sort of goading for
the
blood.
The little boys in the window.
Really
watching,
great.
Going, have they killed each other? Because they kind of collapse at the end, don't they?
Yeah. The sun rays through the people as well. Like it's so great. Like, you know, in the sort of ranking of duels in the movie, I'm not going to do it because it's unfair, but like that third duel, I really felt then I was like, right, there's
probably
no going back.
YouTube videos ranking duels probably already.
Yeah. Guaranteed. Hi guys, today's my top duels from the 1977 film, The Duelist. You know, you can imagine it. Today's sponsors, Raid Shadow Legends.
Nord,
VPN. You might get that joke. But as I say, it's when I felt that it was the point of no return, because I felt the first one was a sort of, it felt like Keitel was lashing out at him with his sword. It didn't really feel like a real duel. The second one, like it was a bit more to do, and Keitel nicked Carradine. But then that third one, it's just, I'm like, right, now they want blood. And obviously Carradine goes from wanting blood to not. But I feel like in that's like the high point of it, perhaps. And then the rest of it just feels like, because of this honor, because of our demand satisfaction, you have to keep doing it.
Exactly. And I think with their first duel, Dubert is just shocked that he's having to fight this idiot
wants
to fight.
What the hell
are you doing? He's literally just, I've come to give you some bad news. Like, that's all I'm here for.
He's like
accidentally insulted the emperor. You know,
the demand satisfaction. He's like, "What? You what, mate? Like,
he's doing his best to try and get out of there."
Yeah.
So much slow. So, like, I think Keitel like slams the door in his mistress's face at one point.
That's it.
But it's, I love how the duels steadily grow, and you go from the absurdity of the first one to the growing tension of the second duel where they're with short swords. And it's completely different to a saber fight because a short sword is very light. It's very nimble.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched like épée fencing on the Olympics, then that is the closest to short sword fighting. That's what épée evolved from. And it's kind of like they do things which very much lean into the fact that they're cavalrymen, they're soldiers. So they're swiping. There's bits of swiping where with the short sword, that's probably not a good idea because they're very nimble blades, you can get underneath someone's guard. And that's what happens to Dubert. Like Keitel goes into a very low lunge and like pierces him through the chest. And he almost doesn't realize until it's a very quick, you can easily miss it. Like he comes back up into the guard and he looks at the end of his blade and you can see blood and he spots the blood and he realizes, oh, I've actually like made contact.
Yeah, it's subtle.
Those swords are like so sharp that they'll pierce easily and you don't even notice. And then Dubert kind of like staggers backwards and can't go on. And then with that third duel, they've been doing this for years, and the frustration and the desire for a conclusion to that is really palpable in that scene. The horseback sequence, which is my favorite scene, finally getting around to one of my favorite scenes, is the tension of that is incredible, because when you think about it, he is so reluctant to go into that, because Alan Armstrong is kind of explained to him, it's a tribute to the cavalry that we're going to do this on horseback.
Yeah.
Because he's been off to talk to Keitel's second, and they've decided, oh, we're going to do it on horseback. And I love the little hints in the dialogue that suggest that through all these duels, these two men have gained this real reputation as both duelists and soldiers and honorable men. And it's really interesting to see Carradine push back at the absurdity of having to fight this man over and over again over nothing.
Yeah,
because it's not even an affair of, you know, it's not a match of the heart, it's not a real affair of honor.
No,
it's just that
you dissed that
Keitel
my boss.
Keitel has taken on this
insult
was just a turn of phrase. It's the kind of dialogue that if you watch it for the first time, you wouldn't even think, oh, well, he's just insulted Bonaparte there. You wouldn't notice. But that becomes the whole crux of the dueling. But that's that duel on horseback, the tension that grows within Caridini's on horseback, and there's those little flashbacks.
And they're great.
And they're almost, it's almost like PTSD in that.
Yeah, I felt that.
It's Keitel's character lunging and attacking him. And kind of just builds and builds, and then there's that release of he manages to chip him, and then he leaps over the hay wagon, shouting for joy because he's won the duel, and that should be it.
Yeah,
but it never is.
No,
Keitel is insatiable.
It's the duel, the whole bloody duel. To bring in a Cruel Sea reference there.
And then we've already mentioned it, but I really do like the scenes in Russia. And I think that gives us the most broad view of the period that we get, because a lot of the sequences are in either a salon or a cafe, or they're in like horse lines, a camp, or they're in a tent. And then the jewels are always in.
It lets the film breathe in a weird way.
It does.
Sort of,
it does. Yeah. Or they're in a courtyard where the fights often take place, or in field where there's nothing really in the distance. It's a beautiful landscape, but there's nothing really there that tells you that this is set in the 1800s. Yeah, but you get to that.
There's a war going on, guys. Like that's what it sort of does for you.
You finally get to that sequence in Russia, and there's the mise-en-scène is on point again. It just feels cold. Frozen men, despondency, Cossacks baying at the edges of them.
Yeah.
And the pinnacle of that is Keitel shouts for volunteers to go and push the Cossacks out of the wood. And as you would imagine, no one's up for that.
Nah.
And so Caridine goes along, probably hoping to end this once and for all. And instead of a duel, they sort of end up fighting off a Cossack patrol, which works really well. And that scene ends with another almost Kubrick-esque shot of the frozen Hussar officer.
It's great. It's so good.
It's very Shining, where it's just this chap that's frozen, sat there, and it just pans back and forth between...
makes me think what Scott's going to do with this mega-budget Napoleon film.
I we'll talk about this later on, but it is. I think, really, the constraint of the budget really helped this film, because I love the way the vignettes work. I really do think that the vignettes of each duel, you know, that shows progression of time and their position as people and the way they feel about the whole process of this, because Perrault is just despondent at times of having to do this. Sorry, Dubert is despondent of having to fight Perrault, and Perrault is increasingly like desperate to it just drives him as a person. Every possible opportunity, he wants to fight Dubert.
Even when Napoleon's deposed, he still wants still wants to smoke. He can't let it go. I love it. I want to know more about Keitel. I'm just like, why is this so important to you? Is it because everything you cared about is gone, and this is the only, this is like the remnant of that? This is like the last
it seems
thing
to
you
be
have
the only thing that really drives him.
It's really great. So maybe we should go into final thoughts.
I think so.
Brilliant. I'll kick off. So, it's a brooding, well shot, very well paced film. I know I'm a little bit annoyed I hadn't seen it before, because I enjoyed this a couple of nights ago when I watched it. I'll enjoy it again. And we talk a lot on the show about having your film set in a historical period and telling a story. You're either telling a true story or you're telling a narrative. You're telling a made up story. And I think this is one of the benchmarks when it comes to setting your film in a historical period, but making a fictional story work. You know, it really does feel like it's in the background of the Napoleonic Wars. I feel like Sharp could turn up at any moment's notice. Like, it's like that. It's just, it just feels so true. It feels so,
captures it, doesn't it?
Dyed in the wool. Yeah, it really captures something. I really think it's just a bit of a triumph, I think.
I agree. I've got to go back to that. The way that Perrault becomes so obsessed, and Dubert, you know, we're dueling as a compliment to the cavalry, and he actually says, "I'm not fanatical enough to persevere with this absurdity," which kind of sums up the process that these two men go through. It's honor before reason, really.
Yeah, of course.
The film's well paced. There's great performances by the leads. I really like some of the dialogue. I think there's a couple of scenes that really, like, this film doesn't pander to you, and it doesn't try and tell you what the Napoleonic Wars are about. It's very much the film set against them. There's just enough for you to understand the insult and the reason why, and also some of the historical changes and the societal changes, which see Dubert's life move into, marrying into an aristocracy and, becoming a general. And they're both generals towards the end. And it's interesting to see the parallels of these careers. I agree, it would have been interesting to see a little bit more of Keitel, to see his sort of trajectory. But again, it's that constraining budget. And to be honest, I love that the budget constrained it into a series of vignettes, which takes you across all of Europe.
I do. I would have hated this to be a sprawling epic, because I think it would have just taken so much away from it.
Oh, I completely agree.
And this is where my sort of...
But it conveys all of Napoleon's like great campaigns in a way without you ever seeing a battle, but it does give you that feel and atmosphere.
No, it really does. But I think this is where my sort of criticism of Scott comes in. So I'm not the biggest Scott fan. So I enjoy his early work. I like Aliens, I like Blade Runner, and I think this has elements in it that he carried on to Alien, carried on to Blade Runner, the sort of the claustrophobic feel, everything feels so small. So, like, you know, in Blade Runner, for instance, you know, you have this massive sprawling cyberpunk-esque city, but when you're on the ground, it feels so small and condensed. This movie has it too. You get the feeling of it's huge on the outside, but you're seeing this tiny little window. And I really enjoy that. I don't really enjoy his movies as much as I used to because I think they just do too much. I kind of am worried a little bit about this Napoleon movie because I'm like, it's 3 and a bit hours long.
Yeah.
I'm like, are we going to feel that same sort of, I want to say claustrophobia, but it's the wrong word. Like, what are we going to have, a duelist type thing? Or are we going to have a overblown biopic?
And no, I think it's going to definitely be on the side of epic in the vein of, you know, Gladiator and Kingdom of Heaven and that kind of thing. It's going to be big. It's going to be, there's going to be a lot of spectacle to it, I hope. Really, it's the detail that I'm most concerned about with Napoleon. And we're going to debate that age-old discussion of, can you nitpick with historical accuracy and those kind of things?
Yeah. Well, famously, is today, hasn't it? Scott's come out and said,
yeah. Well,
what was it? I don't care or something, or get stuffed or whatever. What was the
direct
quote?
He said something of it. He said that people picking a film apart, I think he was responding actually directly to something that Dan Snow said in a video about the trailer. So it's going to be interesting to see it, and it's going to be interesting to see where Napoleon sits within our typical criteria of, is it a good film? Can we forgive historical accuracy issues?
Yeah.
Are the historical accuracy issues actually there? Are they something that we should be worried about?
Because that's
they
what
definitely
this film
don't appear to be in The Duelist.
No, that's what this film does. It could be, you know, they could be wearing hoodies for all I care, but the movie is very good. The story is compelling enough. So much so that when I was watching it, I was texting Matt at the time and I said, you could remake this with football hooligans. Like, and it'd have the
you
same.
You could put the story into another context, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, the fight, the honour, the sort of, there's lots of themes there that are still quite relevant today. I think you could definitely have something else with this story. But as I say, you know, it's a masterclass in using your budget. It's a masterclass in getting a lot of good performances out of your actors. It's just really compelling. Like, I think that's the word for me. It was very compelling. I wanted to know what happened to these people. I was really excited to get to the end. I never felt like it lulled.
No, pacing's
that's quite
great.
Rare for a movie with me. Yeah, the pacing's perfect. And I, as I say, like, what a great whistle wetter for Napoleon later on in the month.
Absolutely. And I hope everyone listening will join us towards the end of November for our episode, taking stock and
discussing
Napoleon. I think
we're hitting it a
Napoleon.
Week after release, aren't we? Because
I think so. I think it's going to be the episode of the 29th of November.
That's it. Yeah. So, Matt, anything more before we do the outro? No, well, that was 1977's The Duelist. I hope you enjoyed our musings on it there. It's, you know, it's out there on DVD. It's out there to find. Hope you go and enjoy it if
on
you haven't
Prime,
seen it.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's on Prime Video to rent. Yeah, do join us again for more war movie reviews. And as always, you can catch up with the entirety of the back catalogue on fightingonfilm.com. And we'll catch you again next week.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye. I demand satisfaction.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.